I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we will talk about the controversial hate crimes legislation that emerged from this session of the Indiana General Assembly. We'll discuss what the new law does, what it doesn't do, and where the state goes from here. My guests are Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce and Mindy Goodpaster of the United Way of Central Indiana. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at WFYI.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the hate crimes legislation that emerged from this session of the Indiana General Assembly. We're going to talk about what the new law says, what it doesn't say, and where the state goes from here. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are a couple of veterans of the program, Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce and Mindy Goodpaster of the United Way of Central Indiana. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
John, good to see you.
It's good to have both of you here. So let's start, set the table here by talking about what did happen, what the new law says. I'll start with Kevin and then let Mindy finish up if there's anything he leaves on the table.
Well, this was a long, hard-fought discussion that, it's a culmination of several years of efforts and failed legislation. I think for the advocates, including the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, Indiana Forward and others, this bill is not exactly what we wanted. Just to quickly run through the process, before session, Governor Holcomb had made passing a comprehensive, what I call meaningful bias crimes legislation, a priority of his for this session. We had other, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, which had not directly been involved in this issue in the past. Our board of directors passed a policy position in favor of taking action, and so we were much more engaged this year. And we started out with a bill. We started out with 10 bills that had various lists on them, and then a couple that didn't have a list of protected characteristics or attributes. The focus became the House said, we're going to wait and see what the Senate does. So all the House bills went by the wayside. And the Senate focused on what became Senate Bill 12, authored by Mike Bohachik from LaPorte County and Ron Alting from West Lafayette. It had a very comprehensive list of protected categories, enhanced criminal penalties for people that committed bias crimes, which are defined in the statute. And there was lengthy testimony. We had a number of members there. I testified. All the other groups did as well. I thought it was interesting. They gave the opponents and proponents an hour and a half each, and the opponents couldn't fill their time. And this was with a 2 or 3 minute limit. And I'm looking at Mindy. For people to testify, and they were very firm about that. Bill came out of committee, from our perspective and others, was in good shape, went to second reading where anyone in the Senate can offer an amendment to change the language of the bill. Before they went on the floor to vote, the Senate Republican Majority Caucus had a lengthy, as in 3-hour, caucus meeting. And out of that caucus meeting determined there was not sufficient support for the bill as it currently stood. They put forth Senator Aaron Freeman from southeast side of Indianapolis, put forth an amendment that stripped all the language out of the bill except the words "and bias," so the judge could consider bias in enhancing the sentence. I think pretty much everyone agreed that was far too vague and unworkable. That bill went over to the House, to the Courts and Criminal Codes Committee. There was another bill also authored by Senator Bohatchik that had to do with enhancing criminal penalties for crimes committed inside prisons, correctional facilities. And he happens to have the Michigan City State Prison in his district. The House leadership, they had lengthy discussions within their caucus. They felt that trying to move Senate Bill 12, there would be many amendments offered, particularly from the opponents. And so instead, they pulled what I would call a procedural move, and they took the Senate Bill 198, which was already on the floor of the House, offered an amendment that took some generic language that Representative Steuerwald had put in an introduced bill that had since died, and then referenced the existing bias crimes reporting statute, which has a number of categories that include a list that is broader than many, many other states' bias crime statute, but it did not include certain categories sought by our organization, Indiana Forward and others, but did include Representative Steuerwald's what I call generic language that said that the judge can consider in any characteristic, trait, affiliation, et cetera, including but not limited to, and then it referenced the list that was in the bias crimes reporting statute. Certainly a bit convoluted, but as Speaker Bosma told me the morning that they adopted that amendment in a phone call that he made, he said, "This is as much as we can get out of our caucus." That bill passed, went back to the Senate, and now Senator Bohatchik has the decision of, do I accept these changes to my bill that started out as a criminal penalty enhancer in prison bill and has become the bias crimes bill, or do I try to take it to conference committee? They had a lengthy caucus discussion, and he concluded that this was as much as I could get out of this legislature this year. And Governor Holcomb ultimately signed the bill the next day, and it's now the law of Indiana.
So what, Mindy, what are the parts that are not in the bill that you would like to see?
So there were several pieces that were missing. When the bill came out of the Senate, as Kevin mentioned, it had all of the pieces that we had been advocating for. So not just a complete and inclusive list, which did include the terms of gender and gender identity. It also had a couple of pieces that were a little bit less publicized in terms of improving our reporting processes, because we don't do a good job reporting hate crimes to the FBI. And it also had law enforcement training. We feel that it's important for law enforcement to be trained on what is a bias crime and how do you look for, the particular evidence if you come upon a crime scene and it's not blatantly obvious that it's a hate crime. So those were the key components that we were thrilled were in the bill when it came out of the Senate committee, and then very disappointed when all of that language was stripped by the Senate subsequently.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about the hate crimes legislation that moved out of the Indiana General Assembly this session. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Mindy, this was a controversial process from start to finish. And we've talked about kind of the merits of what emerged. One of the other issues here was that after that initial hearing, much of the debate on this seemed to take place behind closed doors, which meant that a lot of people guessed at what was going on during the process. How do you think that affected the discussion and also affected the kind of feelings? I don't think anybody proponents, opponents, there seems to be absolutely no one who is really satisfied with the outcome right now.
Right. That's correct. It was really disappointing that the discussion shifted to behind closed doors and in caucus meetings. When we first began the campaign of Indiana Forward and were having discussions, and this started, you know, last summer, actually, after the Carmel Synagogue was vandalized, we had open discussions, we had thoughtful educational discussions with lawmakers, and we were really feeling like the tide had turned and the momentum was shifting in our favor, that this was really going to happen this session. And, you know, as things do go at the State House, I think that there was an element of surprise at how easily the bill moved out of committee with the particular language. And I think that that created an element of tension and possible fear about what the repercussions could be of, you know, the language. You know, to what extent constituents were actually calling in to complain or to express concern, I don't think that really happened. But I think there was just a general nervousness on behalf of the legislature that they didn't want to be painted into a corner if this legislation wasn't going to be popular like they thought it could be. So, you know, as advocates being shut out of the process and not being able to advise, we were not able to give the correct guidance on how the language should be crafted and what needed to be included. And, you know, the merging of Representative Sterwald's language into the bill. So it really, you know, it didn't allow for the education component of it to be had with legislators, that here are the ramifications or the implications if you pass this language. Here's what it could possibly mean. We were cut out of that discussion completely.
Kevin, why was that? Why did so much of this process take place behind closed doors?
There were very different and strong feelings held among majority Republican legislators in both the House and the Senate. They were very difficult, acrimonious, emotional discussions had, and they decided that they would prefer to have those behind closed doors. And I think, again, I think our assessment is that the outcome that occurred was as far as the leadership on both the House and the Senate side could push their caucus members and as good a bill as they could get. And I think there were a number of those folks who didn't want to be educated. And and so I'm not sure that – I don't think that would have made a difference even if this had been more out in the open. But it is frustrating. We're experiencing this with other legislation as well, whether it's anti-smoking legislation or other things. We're finding it increasingly frustrating that more and more of the actual discussions and decision making is coming is occurring in caucus meetings and not out in public hearings.
Mindy, I want to talk a little bit about the closed door nature of all of this, because it has struck some observers that there would have been a therapeutic value to having a good open public debate about this, because it's not just the legislature. There are Hoosiers who have strong feelings on both sides of the question, and we really didn't get a chance to air those out of this process.
Right. That is something that is disappointing because, you know, a lot of folks don't realize some of the conversations that are had and some of the debate that's had. It's, you know, folks don't really understand how decisions are made at the State House. And I think, you know, when a legislator is motivated by their constituents and how they actually respond to an issue, you know, that tends to sway them a little bit better. But if it's only a select few who are calling in and expressing their opinion, that's not really getting at the heart of how their constituents actually feel. I think that it's also something that, you know, we need to know, we need to take the temperature on our legislature. And if there are decisions that need to be made about how legislators are not representing the state or their constituency well enough, that's something that I think should be public knowledge.
We are talking about the hate crimes legislation that emerged from this session of the Indiana General Assembly. My guests are Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce and Mindy Goodpaster of the United Way of Central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, and I encourage you to do so, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the controversial hate crimes legislation that emerged from the Indiana General Assembly this session. My guests are Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce and Mindy Goodpaster of the United Way of Central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Rod has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Rod, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Good afternoon to everybody. I guess my comment or my question is I understand that there was a big anti-push to this hate crimes bill. And if I understand right, I mean, hate crimes bill actually protects everybody overall. I mean, I'm a gay man, you know, living here in Indianapolis. I definitely was not very happy with the last governor because of his anti-gay stance. However, it is my understanding that, I'm beginning to like Eric Holcomb, even though I'm a Democrat. I thought he was more of a champion for everyone. I don't understand why he didn't just, say no to this bill unless it actually came out with the language that everybody wanted. It does not have a language I want, because I would expect that it would clearly identify who would be under this hate crime bill, which really bothered me if they took all that out. You know, whether you're gay, whether you're a woman, whether you're of color or what have you, that really bothers me. My question here ultimately is, what was the main argument against the hate crimes bill? Because in my opinion, I would feel that it would affect everybody if it were put with the language that was supposed to be put there. Thank you for listening.
Certainly.
It.
And thank you for the call and the question, Rod. Mindy, I'll start with you on that one.
Sure. That's a really good question. What was the main argument against the law? And I think that there were some misunderstandings. I think there were some misconceptions about what the law was attempting to do. But one of the chief complaints that we know was it was an attempt to provide special protections to certain populations, particularly the LGBT community. There was a perception that we were somehow elevating them to a different status that would be protected on the law as compared to others, which is absolutely not true. This law would protect everyone. What we were trying to do was define the particular characteristics that are targeted predominantly for hate crimes or bias crimes, so that that was understood by the courts, and so that if a person committed a crime that was motivated by bias against a person because of that characteristic, that they would get, the maximum sentence that could be afforded, or the judge could decide to elevate their sentence, based on the severity of the crime. So everyone, you're correct, would have been included. It's just that we don't have a good definition now for the courts to use in terms of what constitutes a bias crime and, you know, why do we need to take it more seriously than just a regular crime.
Go ahead and jump in.
I'd chime in as well. For the caller, the law that was passed does reference a list, and that includes sexual orientation explicitly. Mm-hmm. In addition, there is language that says the judge may also consider and enhance the sentence if a bias crime is committed. And the bias crime is well defined in the new statute. And for all kinds of other characteristics and categories. So, you know, the argument is made, and I think well made, that mm-hmm. in a sense, everyone that has any sort of affiliation or characteristic that is different than others for which a bias crime may be committed against you and your property, the perpetrator can indeed have their sentence enhanced by a local judge. And that was the opinion of former Indiana Supreme Court Justice Frank Sullivan, a Democrat, mm-hmm. In a letter that he penned to Governor Holcomb the same day that the governor signed the bill. I also had another private conversation with a former Indiana Supreme Court justice and asked the question mm-hmm. and also asked Justice Sullivan if this were law and a clearly bias motivated crime was committed against a transgender individual, do you believe that local judge XYZ would indeed enhance the sentence and add on to the sentence of the defendant? And both of them said, yes, absolutely.
So why was it, you know, it is one of the things that has been interesting about the evolution of this debate. And I think you both referenced earlier in the last segment that efforts to pass hate crimes or bias crimes legislation have been going on for several years mm-hmm. now. A few years ago, sexual orientation seemed to be the huge sticking point. Now it seems to be gender and gender identity.
And more specifically, gender identity, I would say.
Yeah. Correct. So why is that? And what are the things that can address that? What arguments or facts can be used to address that? Kevin.
Well, I don't think there's any reason or excuse not to have put in this legislation, either by expanding the reporting crimes list or putting in a more delineated list, gender identity. There's no valid reason not to do that. But the fact of the matter is there are a number of folks in the two majority caucuses that did not want the words gender identity and any protections for transgenders to be put in Indiana statute. That's a really sad statement on our mm-hmm. legislature, but I believe very strongly that that is factual.
What, you know, was that something they came up with by itself, Mindy, or did you get a sense, what were their stated reasons, or did they state reasons why they did not want gender identity to be listed in this legislation?
There were no publicly stated reasons,
no.
But if you had private conversations, I think that there were some legislators who just didn't understand what transgender is, what a person who is transgender feels or experiences. I think that there are some who have religious convictions that say that transgender is a sin. It's not an acceptable lifestyle, quote unquote. So I think that there was just a lot of fundamental religious disagreement with it, as well as just, I don't understand this phenomenon. So therefore, it must be it's wrong or it's not acceptable.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the hate crimes legislation that just moved through the Indiana General Assembly. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or do what Larry has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Larry, you're on the air.
You know, I have two problems with the hate crime bill and the way it was presented, the testimony and the Senate. They made it seem as if it was a situation where if we don't pass this bill, then the talented people won't come here to Indianapolis or Indiana. Why do they think that that our people that are already here can't be trained to fill those jobs? Why do we have to placate another group of people? And also the deal with I forgot what I was going to talk about, but the way they presented that bill was really embarrassing. And I think that for us to have such a thing to create a new class and another group of people that are going to suffer, because on down the line, the way they do it at the State House, they will be classified as a minority business or a minority in some way and be able to benefit from minority business contracts. Most of these people are white males, and I've got nothing against that, but they shouldn't be classified as a minority or disparate group needing help. And I think for the chamber to come out that way, I know that they have to represent their business people and so forth, but I think you would have more faith in the state of Indiana than to say, if we don't have this legislation, we can't attract any talent, as if the state of Indiana does not already have sufficient talent that needs to be trained. So I was just embarrassed to see that testimony.
Larry, thanks very much for the call and the question. I'm going to give Kevin a chance to respond.
Please. That wasn't exactly an accurate characterization of our position or our testimony. The legislation that passed includes specifically delineated protections for race, religion, ethnicity as well. So this wasn't just about providing hate crimes protections for the LGBT community. Our observation and what we hear from our members, who particularly are national and international, is that we're in an intense competition for talent. And to the caller's point, there isn't enough of it just in Indiana. The Indiana Chamber supports doing anything and everything we can do to enhance the skills of our citizens who are already here to meet the challenges of tomorrow. But the data show, the projections are that between now and 2030, two-thirds of our counties are going to lose population. Well, we currently have more jobs available in Indiana than we have job seekers. So we need to also be simultaneously recruiting people from out of state. And to do so, we need to remove any and all barriers to recruiting those talented people. And they're talented people of all races and colors and lifestyles.
Yeah, I was going to say, because this has been a persistent theme on this program, we've been talking for quite a while about the fact that most economists are predicting a worldwide labor shortage by the year 2030 that could be as high as 25%, which is part of the reason. So let's talk a little bit about the cost of this debate. I was struck, you know, a few years ago when the battle over the Religious Freedom Restoration Act made Indiana kind of a focal point for the nation's and the world's attention, talking to people from around, finding out that, you know, several states said that they weren't going to send people here. At that point, I attended a convention, I think, of newspaper columnists and others that was here, and they said that their attendance had dropped 50% over, you know, over the recent weeks, because a lot of people just decided they weren't going to come in protest over RFRA. We've again had a, you know, another prolonged debate about which people were going to protect through the law and which ones we aren't. What is the cost to the state to keep having what amounts to, in many ways, the same discussion over and over again and not have it come to a satisfactory end? Mindy?
So I think, you know, to the caller, Larry's point about the people who are already here in Indiana, that was certainly part of the discussion. That was part of the debate as well, is not just how do we attract businesses and talent, but how do we retain it here? So how do we ensure that Hoosiers want to stay here and want to live and work here? You know, the United Way, from our perspective, we're sort of, you know, the blend of the philanthropic and business community as well as human services. And we feel it's important that Hoosiers feel safe in their communities, they feel welcome in their communities, because we know that that adds great benefit to the community. If you want to live here, you want to work here, and you feel like you're a member of the community, you won't have any reason to leave. So I think that, you know, there's the human side of the cost as well as the economic. And I know one of the perspectives of one of the members of Indiana Forward was also the health implications. So we know that groups who feel disenfranchised, who feel oppressed, who feel targeted, have worse health outcomes than those who are not targeted. The cost of living in stress, you know, a stressful environment, the cost of anxiety, depression, those can take real tolls as well. And so, you know, the well-being aspect plus the aspect of, you know, if you're a business, are your employees feeling well enough to come to work, or are they experiencing chronic health conditions that's making it more difficult for them to be as productive as they could be?
Kevin, that point of Mindy's, I mean, it has been talked about largely in terms of being a barrier to talent recruitment. Do you worry about it also as a reason perhaps for talent loss? I mean, you know, Mindy made the point that there may be people living in this state, and I've heard from some who say, you know, because I don't feel welcome here, I think I'm going to go live and work someplace else. Is that a source of concern to the membership of the Indiana Chamber?
Well, it certainly was when we adopted our policy position supporting enactment of a meaningful bias crime statute. Hopefully that will change in the future with the passage of this legislation. And now we can say that we have a bias crimes law, albeit not perfect from our eyes or Mindy's organization. But our conclusion was that the combination of the language that is referenced in there with the list on the reporting statute, as well as the what I call the Stirwald language. It was authored by Representative Greg Stirwald. We do have comprehensive coverage for individuals of any and all traits, characteristics, affiliations, et cetera.
Is it enough? I mean, I know the Anti-Defamation League has said this is not this bill was not enough to get us off what Governor Holcomb called the bad list.
Well, actually, they've not, unless it just happened in the last day or so, they have not made a final determination as to whether this gets Indiana off the list or not. They turned into, instead of list keepers, advocates for a specific type of legislation, but their statements so far have not yet been definitive as to whether we're off the bad list or not. So we're waiting to see what they say.
Mindy, do you think it's going to be enough to get us off the bad list and to eliminate kind of the concerns about the reputation of the state?
So in terms of us getting off the list, I think that, you know, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, has certainly said they have concerns in terms of the vagueness of the Stirwald language, but then also the incompleteness of the list. To say that it will get us off, I don't know. That's going to have to be something that we hear definitively from them. I know that in terms of our law, we definitely compare pretty levelly with other states who have, you know, incomplete lists as what we were advocating for. But those laws, just to put it in context, those laws were passed years ago. I mean, some 20, 30 years ago. And those states are currently looking to update their laws, and the ADL is working with them to update their laws. So, you know, to say, well, other states have done it and they're off the list isn't quite accurate, because those states recognize that they don't have complete inclusive laws either, and they need to be updated.
Real quickly, Kevin. Yeah.
In saying that, they're suggesting, and they've suggested us, that the standard for getting off the list in Indiana in 2019 is different than what it was for other states at different points in time, when in fact the list that is enumerated, for example, includes sexual orientation, which only 16 states have that in their statute that are on the good list maintained by ADL. And so, you know, I agree with Speaker Bosma that if they don't take us off the list, then their list is probably arguably meaningless.
We are talking about the hate crimes law that just passed. My guests are Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce and Mindy Goodpaster of the United Way of Central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call or send us an email. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indiana's new hate crimes law today on No Limits. My guests are Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce and Mindy Goodpaster of the United Way of Central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Or do what Lisa has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Certainly.
I'm calling. I haven't had a chance yet to really think this part through, but I'm hearing some really compelling thoughts from friends of mine who are, considered in the category that would be protected by a hate crimes bill. Friends who are Black LGBT, and their main concern with this is just that it's ultimately stronger sentencing. And their issues already with the criminal justice system is that sentencing affects these exact groups more than the majority or like. For instance, Black folks get tougher sentences for drug crimes and things like that. And their concern is that it's a bit of an arms race, and the things that they feel they need to get better.
Okay, let me see. Lisa, let me see if I can frame this. What your friends that you've been talking with us about have been arguing that the weight of the criminal justice system falls disproportionately on certain minorities, such as Blacks,
right.
and all of that, and that this at some level kind of evens the playing field. Is that a fair assessment of what they're saying?
No, their concern is that it will, just like any other law, especially with people not categories not being named. Mm-hmm. Kind of like how RIFRA.
It would end up being used against them. Okay.
Yeah, because we were talking about gay marriage, and then this same legislative body passed RIFRA to protect, Christian organizations from getting in trouble for discriminating.
Okay.
And so their feeling is this hate crimes legislation, and I can see their point very well.
This could boomerang on them.
If we're able to add a bias crime to resisting arrest, for instance, then a Black person could get increased sentencing on top of on top of something. And if our same criminal justice system that has these inherent biases is wielding this new law, they're saying, what's the point? We're just giving them more ammo.
Thanks very much for the call and raising the point. I'm going to let Kevin take it from here. Thank you.
What you're suggesting would actually not be the case, and the reason goes to the definition of a bias crime, and that is a crime committed against a person or their property because of their race, religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation, or other attributes, and that the crime was committed because of that attribute, and that there is clear evidence that the crime was committed because of the person's characteristic or attribute. And so your example of an African-American person resisting arrest, that may be a crime for an African-American person or anybody else, but it's not a bias crime, and therefore the sentence could not be enhanced under the bias crime statute.
I think what she was arguing, though, is if during the course of resisting arrest you utter some sort of epithet or call the police officer a name or something like that, that that can be used as evidence of bias.
That's not a bias crime either,
because
as the statute ended up, law enforcement is not covered. It was in the introduced version of the bill, but not in the final version.
Mindy, you look like you want to say something.
Well, Kevin just said it, that in an earlier iteration of the bill, law enforcement was one of the protected classes. And I think that that's where some of the concern was sparked, because there was a concern that exactly what the caller had expressed would happen. That language was taken out because we know that there already are enhancements for crimes that are against police officers, and it wasn't really something that was necessary. So that part was taken out. But this, as Kevin said, this bill would not impact that type of situation.
And I'm going to stay with you on this one, Mindy, but it occurs to me on something like that, that's yet another argument that there should have been a fuller public debate and discussion of this, because many of these concerns probably could have been addressed if a lot more of this had taken place out in the open.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, we had excellent testimony in the Senate committee, and that was the opportunity to do the education, do the compelling arguments, do the stories, for why this type of law is needed. It was also a time for legislators to ask questions, and we had a lot of insightful questions. We had never had the opportunity in the House to have that type of discussion. We had never had a committee hearing. We had never had any public debate or discussion. We could not offer that same type of education to the committee members and, elicit the same type of questions from them to get those questions answered. And that was a huge detriment to the entire process.
We are talking about the hate crimes law that just moved out of the Indiana General Assembly. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you taking my call. It's a
Certainly.
Wonderful discussion today. Yes, just a second ago, your panelists were discussing and kind of pondering the idea why some of this transgenderism language did not make it into the bill, and how that actually reached across both aisles, Republican and Democrat. Well, just to be quite frank, I believe they were embarrassed, because the majority of Hoosiers still believe that transgenderism is a mental disorder. Whether some of your panelists like that, they have to understand that that's the mentality out here. We believe that transgenderism is a mental disorder, and that's why you have people on both sides of the aisle not wanting to put that language in it, because they know once they start to pander to that it never ends, and all of a sudden a person can say they're a dog, and then that could be considered, and it just doesn't ever end, we feel like. And so we want the buck to stop here. We want people to know that this is what most Hoosiers believe, that this is a mental disorder, and we can't pander to that. And that's why you had issues on both sides of the aisle. I think it's because they felt embarrassed to put that language in.
Thanks very much for the call, David.
Yes,
Mindy.
I hear what you're saying, David, and I definitely appreciate you sharing your thoughts. And the issue really is, whether or not folks believe that transgenderism is a mental disorder, or if they believe it's an actual phenomenon or what have you. It doesn't matter where you stand on your personal beliefs about the issue, really. The fact of the matter is that it's not okay to target a person and commit a crime against them because of the fact that they may or may not be transgender. A person's dislike of that disorder, that's fine for you to believe, but it's not okay for you to commit a crime against a person because of that. Despite the fact that reporting is pretty low, we don't have good reporting on the actual crimes that take place. We know that transgender people are disproportionately targeted over other individuals because of the fact that they may or may not be transgender. They are perceived to be transgender. And we would argue that despite your beliefs about it, you don't have the right to target a person, you know, vandalize their property. You don't have the right to assault them. You don't have the right to murder them because you disagree with who they are. And so that's where the distinction lies. And that's why it's so important to clarify within the statute that this is a phenomenon. We know that these folks are indeed targeted. We have data that shows it. And that's not okay. We don't believe that it's okay to commit a crime against a person because of it.
Why, you know, this obviously was an incredibly hard debate. And going into it, looking at the hearing back in January, again, it didn't look like it was going to be this way. And I don't think I have seen that many issues in this state. And I'm a fairly acute observer of Indiana politics, where you had the business community lining up. Many not-for-profits, such as much of the academic community, many community organizations, you know, most of the major employers in this state, and yet somehow it still came down to the wire and in a way that, again, left no one entirely satisfied. What was it that was so hard about all of this, Kevin?
Well, contrary to your statement, I thought and knew this was going to be a difficult battle from the beginning. If just by looking back at the bills that had been proposed and had failed in the last four or five sessions, and you know, I think largely it boiled down to the fact that you had the religious right and the groups that represent them in the state house were committed to fighting this tooth and nail, and the majority caucuses in the House and the Senate have a lot of members who are deeply connected to those organizations and to those causes. And so this was, in fact, going to be a difficult battle. We were bolstered by the fact that we had the governor on board. We had organizations like ours that were coming on board more strongly and more actively than in the past. But at least from where we sat, this was still going to be a very difficult battle all the way along.
Mindy, your thoughts?
I absolutely agree with Kevin. Having followed this issue for the past several sessions, we knew it would still be a difficult discussion. What we had hoped was that because we had some incidents recently in the past couple of years that really hit home, that that was going to change some of the discussion. And I think that it did.
And it certainly changed public opinion because
it
polled very high and very favorably among voters of all political parties, races, demographics.
Right. Absolutely. I think part of where the difficulty was the still fresh in our memories, RFRA. Issue and what a debacle that caused. And I know that Speaker Bosma had come out early on, actually at your legislative luncheon, saying he did not want another RFRA effect. And so that was still very fresh in everyone's minds. They didn't want the state to suffer a black eye again because of this discussion.
So where do we go from here on this? I mean, the number I have heard is that the current law takes the state to about 85%. I don't know how they arrived at that figure. The way that the proponents of a hate crimes bill wanted it to go, is there a chance that your organizations will be going back to try to get that other 15%, or does this end the debate? Mindy, I'll start with you.
I think from United Way's perspective, this certainly does not end the debate for us. We still firmly believe that we need to include the other classes or characteristics within the definition. But we recognize that there are many, many legislators and leadership who feel that this is it. We've done it. We're good to go. So I think it's going to take a while. One train of thought is that we can just wait and see how effective this law is when it's implemented and see how the courts use it. And if we can generate any public favor for that, if it's not working, if it looks like it's not being used effectively, then we can come back maybe in a couple of sessions and say, here, you know, we know that it's not working. Here's how we need to fix it. But my, you know, my sense is that at least in the short term, in the next session or two, we're probably not going to be able to make any changes.
Kevin.
I would agree with that conclusion. I think it is important to see how the courts use this legislation to enhance penalties on crimes, what are clearly biased crimes committed against people or property of any characteristic. And based on that, we'll know that it works. We either know that it works well or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then that may create an opportunity to come back and put in statute a more delineated, comprehensive list. But certainly I see no appetite or action by the General Assembly on this for the near term or for really the foreseeable future.
So one of the things that seems to have come out of this discussion, I've got an email from a listener named Vanessa who says, I have been working on a research paper about the Indiana hate crimes legislation. I'd like to take some time to interview someone who is involved in this debate. Is there a person email that I can contact? Thank you. I'll tell you what, I will hand the email to this email so that we don't give Vanessa's email out to thousands of listeners here to the two of you and see if you want to get back with her. But I'd like to broaden that to a discussion of there clearly seems to be a lot of confusion still out there about what this bill did. Where would you suggest that people go to get accurate information about where things stand? Kevin, I'll start with you, but I want to hear Mindy's thoughts too. And we got about 90 seconds left.
Well, first thing that comes to mind is they can go to IndianaChamber.com and find information, articles, legislative update articles that we've written and information that we'll have on our website.
Okay, so IndyChamber.com?
No, Indiana
Chamber. IndianaChamber.com. Oh. That's right. We send them over chamber. To Huber's, yeah, otherwise.
We'll fill up his inbox.
Mindy.
Likewise, Indiana Forward, so that's IndianaForward.org, also has information. We have a lot of background fact sheets. We've got examples of other laws and other Supreme Court cases and things of that nature. So you can go to that website and check it out. Also, call your legislator. Call your legislator and talk to them and find out why they voted the way they did and what their perception is.
We have got still some callers waiting and all of that. We're clearly out of time here. So I often ask our callers and our guests if there's an appetite to continue the conversation, that see if you'd be willing to answer comments on our Facebook page or deal with questions there.
Absolutely.
No Limits WFYA.
Yeah, they're in contact us directly.
Right.
In my case.
Well, I would like to thank my guest, Kevin Brenniger of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Mindy Goodpaster, the United Way of Central Indiana, for what has been a lively conversation about Indiana's new hate crimes law. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.